keeping it real awkward.
Oh, thanks for the wave. Also, welcome to those of you that are watching online as well. Hope your day is off to a great start. I have announcements for all of us. The first being that next Sunday at 10:30 a.m., which is our normal service time, we do 9 and 11 just at Easter, but we're going to gather together here in this space for a brunch, and we are going to sit around tables and enjoy conversation with each other. And so I just want to invite you back to that. We would just love the chance to be able to connect with you, and we serve a breakfast casserole for anyone that would be brave enough to bring one. We need a few more of those so that we're all full and happy and it feels less awkward. Because if you don't want to answer a question like what's your deepest, darkest thing you've ever done in your life, you just stuff your mouth full of that casserole. That's my strategy. No, we do not ask those questions. They're more like, what's something in your life that's bringing you joy right now? Okay, well, move on. Also, as a part of that morning, we are going to be having a baptism. And so for those of you that are like stepping towards saying, I don't have this all figured out, but I want to follow Jesus, we invite you to be baptized. And Jason will talk a little bit more about that in the message, but I just wanted to throw that out there as well. And then we have here something that we do in the summer to reach out to our community called Soccer Club. And it is a week of running around mostly in the hot sun and investing in kids and like helping them to believe that they matter, that they're valued and that they're seen. And we just love what we get to do together. So if you have friends, you yourself would like to sign your kids up for Soccer Club, the date is behind me. It's in July, and we also need a plethora of volunteers. And so a couple weeks from now, I'm going to start kind of the real planning and the groundwork for Soccer Club. And if you think you'd be available to help out in any way, there's coaching, there's assistant coaching, there's like field maintenance and setup, there's check-in, there's a little store that we have where we hand out prizes. So lots of different ways for you to invest if you're able to. So sign up on your Connect card, and those are on your seats, and we love to hear from you. So fill that out, mark whatever boxes make sense for you, and at the back of church today, there's a little basket, and you can drop those in on your way out. And for those of you that are watching online, we have an online Connect card by going to brookviewchurch.com/contact. So
well, happy Easter. Whoa. Thank you for that. That's good. You know what? The last service was packed and they were pretty hyped, but you guys can totally outdo them. I know you can. Many of you know that growing up, I didn't go to church and that I was a like obnoxious, devout, outspoken atheist. But the way of Jesus clicked for me when I was 20 years old, and it has changed everything about how I see the world. Within a few months of that happening, I moved to Yakima and I started attending a Vineyard church. Any of you Vineyard church goers at some point in your life? One. Okay. You guys, it was very charismatic. Like, people spoke in tongues. The worship was amazing. Lots of people had a prophetic word for other people. They were big on supernatural healing. I was a brand new Christian. I didn't know what was what. I was also a college baseball player, a pitcher with an injured shoulder, and my whole identity was wrapped up in being good at baseball. Like, I really had no idea who I was or what was valuable about me apart from this one thing that I did. So one morning at church, the music was in full effect. I mean, it was rocking. And they invited people forward for healing. And I was like, I might as well. And I explained through the music, I'm like, so my shoulder's, you know, it was actually the other shoulder, I'm right-handed. My shoulder's injured, you know, I was trying to explain it all. And they're like listening. And with spine-tingling worship, just like piercing my soul, and a team of trained spiritual healers laying hands on me, I genuinely sensed that God's power could and would heal my shoulder. And you guys, they prayed their hearts out for me. Like, it was touching. I truly sensed that God would supernaturally heal me. I wasn't certain, of course, but I felt like it was going to happen. It didn't happen. Nothing changed. And I had to give up my dream. And I had to feel lost for the next year or two and try to find a new identity and figure out who I was. People prayed over me in faith. I received it in faith. Those that prayed were sincere. I was sincere, but nothing. Okay, then in 2008, I had a very different kind of experience with healing. We went on our first trip to Haiti with a team of 12 people from Brookview. And you guys, we didn't know anything. This was our first mission trip as a church. We were a brand new church. We didn't know anything. We just trusted somebody that had been to Haiti many times to lead us and show us the way. And on that trip, we did something foolish. We did something I'll never do again. We camped for 4 days in a small village among the Haitians, like in Coleman tents, for 4 days. Because here's the thing with people on mission trips. They're like, I don't want to live above the people. You know, that just feels so. I want to get right in there with them. And so we got right in there with them. And then people were like, that was dumb. Because we just had camps to tent, you know, just to tents to sleep in. Like, it was, there was no running water, there were no toilets, there was just a hole in the ground wrapped with sheet metal. We got in that village, and many of us were like, 4 days. I can make it 4 days, you know. It's about 105 degrees every day, and at night it would cool down to like 95, you know, like 4 in the morning. So refreshing. And in that village, most of us got sick in some way. The first person to get sick was Jeff Satterthwaite. Many of you know Jeff. And he and Monica moved to Arizona a few years ago, and man, do we miss them? Yes, we miss them. But in that village, so Jeff got what we'll just call intestinal distress, the kind that causes frequent bathroom use. And so Jeff is in the sheet metal sitting over that hole about every 20 minutes or so. And this goes on for a few days. And then, you guys, it was my turn. So we're all kind of hanging out, and someone remarks about my problem. And Jeff's wife, Monica, says, Jason, do you have a sick tummy? And so I sheepishly nodded. And so she said, Do you need some Cipro? Now, Cipro is an antibiotic, prescription antibiotic that you take to third world countries for this very issue. And we had told the whole team to get some from their doctor and bring it. And so Monica says, Jason, do you need some Cipro? Jeff and I have plenty. And after several days of misery, Jeff says, we do? She's like, oh, yeah, sorry, babe, I should have told you, we have lots. You know, when the pastor got sick, then I thought of it. But there was a lot of sickness over those days, and the heat alone was just, like, shocking. It was an issue. And then we weren't sleeping well on the ground in these tents at night in the heat. We're battling dehydration. We didn't shower for several days. There was, like, just diaper wipe baths. You guys, it was rugged. I will never, ever, ever do a trip like that again. We learned. Like, it turns out it's really hard to serve people well when everyone's just wiped out. But in that village, the sickest person was a young woman named Chelsea. She and her husband, Adam, were in their mid-20s, recently married, and Chelsea was so sick that she couldn't even get up. She was having all kinds of abdominal pain, and it was bad. So we gathered for dinner at night, and Chelsea and Adam weren't—they didn't come. Adam stayed behind just to be with his wife, and so I decided, oh man, like I better go check on him. And I was like, this is serious. We might need to get a doctor if this doesn't clear up soon. So I went to the tent and I asked him how she was. I like stood outside the tent. You know, the Coleman tents, like you get the little window thing you can talk through. And so I was asking, you know, if they thought we might need medical care. And they're like, we might if this continues. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we're in a remote village in Haiti in this valley. Like, I don't know how this is. So from outside the tent, I was just like, can I pray for you? And I prayed God would heal her, that she would feel better, that she would be able to go and do what she came to do. I prayed, and then I went back to dinner, and you guys, 5 minutes later, Adam and Chelsea come bursting into dinner, and Adam says, you won't believe this, but like right after you walked away, Chelsea sat up suddenly, and he's like, it totally freaked me out because I thought she was like dying or something. And Chelsea jumped in, and she's like, yeah, so when you were praying for me, I got this sharp pain in my belly, and when you stopped praying, it stopped, and suddenly I felt completely fine. Thank you. You know, we had Glenda in the last service. We got Tony in this one. She's like, so I sprang up and it totally freaked Adam out. She's like, but get this, like, I feel great. Like, I feel fine. And everyone at the table is looking at me like, what did you do? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I just prayed and asked for healing. And it was this surreal moment. It was like whoa, and we were all in awe. And Chelsea, it turned out, was truly fine. Like after that, she was 100% healthy. And she was amazing on that trip. She was serving people, loving people, just so tender with the kids, endless energy in some really difficult circumstances. She was incredible. Okay, years later, a man in our church and very good friend of mine got cancer. Chris Perry was in his 30s with a wife and two beautiful little girls, and we had prayer meetings for Chris, asking God for healing. His family prayed, his friends prayed, our church prayed, his parents' church prayed, lots of churches prayed. Chris was anointed with oil, whole groups laid hands on him and prayed, and he got sicker and sicker and sicker, and he died. And losing Chris was devastating. While that was going on, my son, Cameron, got a brain injury playing football. It was around his 13th birthday. And in his teens, we watched him just slowly disintegrate. Depression, anxiety, addiction, suicide attempts. We watched this confident, athletic, smart, fun, joy-filled kid fall apart. And we prayed like crazy. So did the church. So did our extended family and their churches. And after 5 years of this, you guys, 5 years of this, at 18 years old, in the ICU after another overdose, Jen and I were sitting next to him in his bed, and Jen just explained to him through tears. She was like, sweetheart, we don't know how to help you. The doctors and mental hospitals and treatment programs, they're not working. And she said, I've been sensing from God for quite some time. I've been talking with Dad about it, and I've been sensing from God for quite some time that maybe we should ask you if you want a fresh start. What would you think of moving to Haiti to hit reset and start over? Because as a kid, whenever we would go there on our trips as a family, you would always come alive in that place, like in a special way. Nothing seems to be working here. What do you think? And he said, let's do it. Like nothing else here is working. I'd like to try it. And you guys, it was a move made in desperation. I mean, it just felt like the right thing, but can we just acknowledge Haiti? When you have someone in your family that's not doing well, sending them to Haiti is not really, you're like, what should I do? Uncle Eddie, you know. But many of you know what's happened. Cam's lived there for almost 5 years. And we didn't have the church lay hands on him or anoint him with oil. That didn't make sense in that season. He didn't want that. We prayed for him from afar, and we pleaded with God, and it got worse, and it got worse, and it got worse for 5 years. And then when he was 18, he moved to Haiti to live in a village with no running water, no electricity. It was dirty, hot. He was living with a Haitian family. And somehow, over the last 5 years, God has done an absolute miracle in Cam. I mean, he has joy. He has friendship. He has meaning, purpose in his life. And he has Jesus. He's deeply re-engaged his walk with Jesus. And you guys, you can just like see the fruits of the Spirit bubbling out of him. There's love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. And now it wasn't immediate when he relocated to Haiti. It wasn't an instantaneous healing, right? It was more of a progressive one. But for any of you guys that knew him 5 years ago and you know him now, it is obvious, isn't it? That something supernatural has occurred. It's ridiculous. I mean, he was on death's doorstep, and now he's filled with life. Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life." Words from Jesus that can be heard at revivals and at funerals. Words that give us faith for the miraculous. Words that give comfort to the grieving. But also words that raise really difficult, painful questions. Why does God answer some prayers and not others? Why does God give one family a miracle and not another? Why are some given extra years of life while others go helplessly to the grave? Today on Easter, I want to explore this statement of Jesus in its context. So let me set the stage for the statement that Jesus makes. This is John chapter 11. It says, "Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, 'Lord, the one you love is sick.'" So Jesus is with his disciples in another town, and he gets word that his friend is sick. Lazarus and his sisters, Mary and Martha, were close, like longtime friends of Jesus, and he and his disciples would go to their home often, and he loved them. It appears that Jesus had been especially close with them for many, many years, possibly family friends from like his childhood. So these are like his inner circle. So with Jesus out and about healing and doing miracles all over Israel, Lazarus' sisters send word, "Lord, the one that you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days, and then he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." So please notice, Jesus does not immediately go to Lazarus. He waits 2 days, and then he makes the journey back to Judea. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Mary and Martha are both grieving the loss of their brother. And in their grief, they each say the exact same thing to Jesus. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Martha says this to Jesus, standing on 2 feet, looking him face to face, processing mostly intellectually. Martha says it to Jesus, or Mary says it to Jesus, on her knees at his feet in utter despair, processing mostly emotionally. And I think that we've all seen that people process loss and grief differently. Some isolate. Some want community, lots of people. Some weep. Some process stoically, internally. Some distract themselves. Some are angry. Some lash out, and on and on. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. So Jesus arrives on the scene to what's the modern-day equivalent of a funeral. Many have gathered to comfort the sisters and grieve with them. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask. So Martha comes to Jesus, and she's grieving, but there's like still this faint hope, right? I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask. She's seen Jesus perform miracles, and she's heard stories of many, many more, and she's trying not to get her hopes up. Have you ever been there? She's trying not to get her hopes up, but she's wondering what might happen next. Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." And you guys, it feels to me like she's kind of probing here. "I know that my brother will rise one day far into the future when God will breathe life into the dead." Is that what you're talking about, Jesus? Or are you suggesting something more immediate, like he will rise today? Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" Jesus doesn't address the question she's probing at. What he does is he affirms Martha's faith, and then he insists that he is the foundation on which her faith rests. "I am the resurrection and the life," meaning I am the Savior who defeats death. "And I am the entry point into the fullest, freest, most uncorrupted sort of life. Your hope is exactly right, and I am the foundation of that hope. Do you believe this? Martha, do you rest your grief and your hope on me?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God who has come into the world." So she understands exactly what he's really asking, and she affirms it. But still, she has no idea what any of this is going to mean for the present moment. Like, have you been there? "I believe, but I don't know what you're going to do now." She's cautious but hopeful. So she goes and gets her sister, Mary. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And she just like cries out with this burst of emotions. Where were you? Right? Like, why didn't you come, Jesus? Now it's too late. And I love you and I believe in you and I trust you, but I am hurt and I'm confused and this is breaking me. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. So Mary falls at Jesus' feet weeping. "Lord, if you had only come sooner, you could have saved my brother." Mary's intellectual, cerebral belief in Jesus, it's not been shaken. Like Martha, she really believes in Jesus. She really believes he's the Messiah. She really believes he has the power of God. But future theological certainty does little to remove the current sting of grief. Have you been there before? When together forever one day in heaven cannot remove the anguish that I feel on this day? And Jesus absorbs into himself all of her pain and her grief and her confusion. John says Jesus is deeply moved in spirit, and Jesus begins to weep. But why? That's kind of weird. Because when you think about it, Jesus already knows that Lazarus is about to be raised. And yet, Jesus has this like momentary breakdown. This is not watery eyes. The picture of the word that's used here, the Greek word, is like uncontrollable sobbing. You guys, this is like an ugly cry. This is all of the humanity of Jesus coming out. Like there was probably like snot and stuff. This is ugly. But when you think about it, it's like, if Jesus knows what's about to happen, why is he weeping? Well, apparently, he takes into himself the grief of those that he loves, Mary and all the others, and he is completely swept up in this moment in their pain. The author that's probably shaped my faith the most is C.S. Lewis. Any C.S. Lewis fans in here? He's awesome. Books like Mere Christianity and the Screwtape Letters and many other like adult books, but also like the Narnia series. Isn't that thing just killer? It's so good. I mean, those children's books, there's so much theological depth that is woven into them. And in one of those, the magician's nephew, Diggory, the child the story centers around, approaches Aslan the lion, so this representation of Jesus, with a question. Diggory's mother is dying, and there's no cure for her condition, and suddenly Diggory discovers this magical world that all centers around Aslan. And he starts to wonder if Aslan might heal his mother. So he approaches Aslan to make the request, and this is what happens next. It says he had been desperately hoping that the lion would say yes. He had been horribly afraid it might say no. But he was taken aback when it did neither. So in the face of real, critical, life-threatening need, Diggory worked up the nerve to ask, and he got no answer. And you guys, this is an experience that I have had before and will have again. This is a felt experience most of us know all too well. And it is brilliantly captured in this children's story. But what comes next takes this scene to another level. Diggory shifts from like reserved and hopeful to impassioned and desperate. But please, please, won't you? Can't you give me something that will cure mother? Up till then, he had been looking at the lion's great feet with the huge claws on them. Now, in despair, he looked up at its face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life. For the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. So in the shining tears of Aslan's eyes, Diggory saw deep sorrow, care, and love. And this boy, Diggory, if you know anything about C.S. Lewis's life, it's like an autobiographical character for C.S. Lewis himself. Because like Diggory, Lewis grew up with a single mother, and like Diggory, Lewis lost her when he was 10 years old. So here's C.S. Lewis, like this world-renowned philosopher and theologian, a professor at Cambridge and Oxford, one of the most brilliant thinkers of his era, decades removed from it, still processing the grief of his childhood, still working out the loss of his mother through this fictional character. Like Mary, C.S. Lewis looked into the eyes of God, and like Mary, he did not get the answer that he wanted, or any answer at all, but what he discovered eventually was the love and care in God's face. And all through the Bible, from Moses to Jesus, God is described, like the biblical authors insist that God is compassion, a word literally meaning co-suffering. In other words, God is the one who feels our pain and he grieves alongside us. God is the one who weeps when we weep. So let's keep reading. Verse 38. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." You guys, I like the old King James of this translation, because she says, "But Lord, by this time he stinketh." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I think that you have heard me. I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Can you guys imagine this? Lazarus is resurrected. He's raised to life. And the way that Jesus did it we're told was to call out in a loud voice, which surely is a reference that the disciples will remember from what Jesus said in John 5, where he said, "Very truly I tell you, a time is coming and has now come when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. Do not be amazed at this, for a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done what is good will rise to live, and those who have done what is evil will rise to be condemned." In the resurrection of Lazarus, Jesus is reaching, he's reaching back to a promise in John 5, and he's reaching forward to a promise of what's coming in John 20, his own resurrection. The miracle of Lazarus' resurrection is a sign. It's more than a miracle, but it is a sign that's pointing to something. It's a sign pointing to Jesus' identity and authority, and it's a sign pointing to a future reality for all of us. Jesus says to this grieving sister, "I am the resurrection and the life." Then he calls Lazarus out of his own grave. You guys, this is big-time healing. I mean, there's like small-time healing and there's big-time healing. This is big-time healing. But it fits into the same category as any earthly healing, right? Physical healing, emotional healing, relational healing. Jesus can and does all of these on occasion right here and now. But the thing is, in this life, it never comes in all of its fullness. Never. Like, there is a fundamental difference between healing in the now and the salvation that is to come. Healing's a sign that in the present that points us to the future reality of salvation. Like, healing is a small taste of the kingdom that points to what is coming one day in full. Healing is a here and now sign that points to salvation, what's coming in full. So there's hope that God will move right here, right now, whenever he does, it's a little taste of what's to come one day in full. Jesus is saying to Martha before she sees the resurrection of her brother, he says to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" Well, not long after, Jesus suffers. And Jesus dies. And Jesus is put into his own tomb. And after 3 days, he walks out of the grave. And that first Easter gives us hope for forever. And that hope can never be taken away. That hope is for anybody who calls on Jesus. So often in our culture, when we think of heaven, we just think of the popular beliefs about heaven. We think of it as like this disembodied escape. Right, it's this world is filled with pain and suffering, and so the kingdom is escape. It's this disembodied euphoric state of like woo. Right, this state of we don't know what. Many envision some kind of like vague, like immaterial bliss, but the biblical picture of the kingdom in all of its fullness of salvation, it's not a disembodied existence at all. It's not non-physical. It is an embodied physical experience. The promise is that just as Jesus was raised bodily, so too we will be raised bodily. According to Jesus, heaven is not an escape. It's a renewal. It's a renewal of all things, of the earth, of the trees and vegetation, the animal kingdom, human bodies, human relationships. It's the healing of all things in every way. Jesus is like, this is what's coming. For everyone who wants to participate in it. Like our relationship to creation, our relationship to God, to one another. No more shame, no more sickness, no more hate or anger, no more violence, no more disease, no more disabilities, no more hunger or poverty anywhere for anyone. No more human hierarchy, no more degradation of anyone in any way, no more distance from God, just close connection, intimate relationship with God, salvation. This is the kingdom. This is the promise. I mean, people often, and I think for good reason, look at the suffering in this world and ask, why doesn't God do something? And the answer is, in Jesus, he did, and he is, but way more is coming. And many of you have experienced a taste of the kingdom in some way. right? Like he's healed your body or he's healed a relationship. For some of you, he has resurrected a marriage. For others, he's healed anxiety or depression or addiction. Like you felt stuck and you felt lost and you felt hopeless, and then God touched you and the kingdom touched you and you got a little taste of what's coming one day in full. Jesus said that the kingdom of God is present. He said it's at hand. Sometimes he talked about it like it's already here. Other times he talked about it like it's coming one day. So which is it? It's both. It's here in part right now, but it's coming in full one day in the future. But this is the hard part. We live here now. And the kingdom is not completely here, not yet, not right now. There's so much suffering and pain and grief and loss and heartache. And so we live in the tension of the already and the not yet. So when it comes to randomness and mystery, the randomness and mystery of present-day healing, some of you in this room, you have a miracle story. You do. You have your own miracle story, like Chelsea or like Cameron. Others of you, you have a disappointment story, like my shoulder, or far worse, a disappointment story like Chris Perry. But here's what I would imagine. I would imagine that quite a few of you in this room have some of both. And as painful as the reality of this is, Jesus said it's to be expected because we live in the tension of the already and the not yet. Tyler Staton says it like this. He says, Jesus has been victorious over sin, and we can know that victory right now, already. But for the full experience of that victory, we're still waiting on Jesus' return, not yet. And over a lifetime of apprenticeship with Jesus, you will experience the overwhelming joy of the already, and you will experience the pain and tension of the not yet. And that tension is made bearable only by a God who didn't shy away from either. By Jesus, who was a victorious Savior, a king ushering in a kingdom. By Jesus, who was a suffering servant and a man of sorrows. And so if you're wondering about a particular thing in your world right now, is it God's will to heal? Yes, of course. God wills healing. God always wills healing, and God will heal all of our pain for good. Like, that is the promise. What we're unclear on is when or how that healing is going to occur. We live in the tension of the already and the not yet. And that's where it gets fuzzy, and that's where it gets complicated and confusing and upsetting. And that's where we are left without answers, what feels like silence. And that's where we have to, you guys, we have to, in faith, look into Aslan's eyes. So let me just say this. The safest thing about praying for healing is that the God that we pray to is good. And he loves us. And he repurposes everything, like everything, even our suffering, into our healing and our redemption. There is nothing that you or I will experience this side of eternity that he will not weave into the tapestry of our redemption. We long for healing because it's right now. God, heal me. I need you to heal this thing. I need you to free me from this pain. I need the immediate relief, God. But you guys, healing in this life is always short-lived. I mean, think about it. All present healing is temporary. Everyone who gets healed will one day get sick again. They will one day get hurt again. Their body will wear out with age, and ultimately, they will die. Like the blind man in John 9 had his eyes opened by Jesus. Can you imagine being there for that? But then one day, his eyes did close for good. And the paralytic who picked up his mat and walked, one day he was laid down and he was laid down for good. And Lazarus, who walked out of the tomb, eventually he did have a second funeral. Jesus wants us to not confuse a little taste of healing today with the forever feast that's coming, okay, what we call salvation. And based on your background, when we hear salvation these days, just the word salvation, as a pastor, I don't even like to use it because it conjures up all sorts of weirdness for people. And it just sounds like salvation, redemption. You know, I mean, it's just, so based on your background, you know, when we hear the word salvation these days, many people are thinking of like altar calls and repeat after me prayers. And you guys, that stuff has its place. But really, it's not salvation. Biblically, salvation is just the fullness of life. Jesus said, I have come that they may have life and have it to the what? Full. It's a salvation, right? It includes the forgiveness of sins, but it goes way beyond just the forgiveness of sins to the fully redeemed life where everything is healed forever. Life to the full as God intended it for all eternity. John begins his gospel previewing what the whole story is about. He's like, let me tell you what this whole story in my gospel is going to be about. It's going to be about Jesus. And he says, in him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. And then at the end of John, after telling the story, John writes, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. I am the resurrection and the life, said Jesus. That's a statement of how, but it's also a statement of what from Jesus. I am the resurrection. I'm the how. My sacrificial suffering and victory over death are the way. You can come alive through me, what I have done for you. I'm the how. But then he gives us the what. He says, and I am the life. And that's about both quality and quantity. Jesus is like, yeah, it's true that this life that I'm offering to you is eternal. Like it will go on forever. But here's something more profound. It's a life of such a quality that you'd actually want to live it forever. Dallas Willard writes that the message of Jesus himself and the early disciples was not one just of forgiveness of sins, but rather one of newness of life. One of my favorite, like most vivid memories of childhood is my mom baking. Do any of you have vivid memories of your mom baking? So, oh man. I just remember being a kid like 4 or 5 years old, sitting at the counter and watching. And my mom was like, she was skilled. I would sit there and I would watch her in awe. She would, you know, it was like cake and pie and cookies and brownies. And all of it was like from scratch, just as her mom. My mom made this amazing like blackberry pie. We had blackberries in our front yard. I mean, just a la mode. But everything she did other than the ice cream was all from scratch. It was just as her mom taught her. And you guys, as a kid, I would sit there like wide-eyed, and she loved that I was there. She would look up at me sitting in the chair at the counter, and she'd just give me a smile. And she could feel my admiration, which I think was nice. But even more than that, she could feel my anticipation. And she knew I was dreaming of the finished product, right? And every once in a while, she would say, hey, you want a taste, Jason? And she'd give me a little spoonful of cookie dough or hand me a beater to lick or whatever. And some days, like, sitting there, I couldn't wait for her to, like, offer. I'd just get too antsy, and I'd be like, can I get a taste, Mom? And sometimes she said yes. And other times she said no. For reasons I couldn't understand as a 5-year-old, sometimes I had to wait until the cake or the pie was done. I had to wait until the cookies or brownies were baked. But what was never in doubt was that she loved me. And she would just smile at me sitting at the counter. And when the time came, whenever she finished baking, I knew that I was going to sit at the table with the finished product, and the pie or the cake or the cookies or whatever, they were going to be freaking amazing. Better than a taste of dough. Better than a lick of the beater. Many of you have experienced the kingdom in some way in your life already. You know it. It's undeniable for you. God's touched your life. Like he's given you a friend when you needed one. He's given you peace in a really tough season. He's healed your body in some way. He's healed a broken relationship. He's resurrected a marriage. He's brought you through depression or anxiety or suicidal thoughts. Maybe God has healed a behavior pattern or an addiction that was destroying you. For reasons we can't possibly comprehend, sometimes we get a taste, and other times we don't. There's still pain and loss and sorrow and grief. But if we sit at the counter and watch God do his thing, we can always know that when the table is finally set, we will have a place at the table and a full plate. There is a huge difference between present-day healing and the fullness of salvation. God wants us sitting at the counter, and he wants us to ask for a taste, but he doesn't want us to confuse the beater with the baked brownies. So this is the key to the whole deal. We ask for and receive all we can get in the now, but our ultimate trust is in the not yet. In the beginning, God miraculously brought into existence all creation, right? The sun, the stars, the earth, the oceans, and the land, and all of life. He brought that out of nothing. And one day, he will miraculously restore it all, like supernaturally heal it once and for all. That's the promise of Jesus, salvation. In the meantime, we sit at the counter watching him work, and we get handed a beater from time to time in his grace, in his kindness. But he wants us to know that the present taste pales in comparison to what's coming. We're all invited to the table, to the feast, to a full plate. How? I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? So if you want to experience both the healing of the now in whatever way God is willing to give it and the salvation of Jesus, like, what in the world do you do? Well, it depends, completely depends on where you're at in your journey of walking with Jesus. Like at the beginning, to signal the initial step into an active and living faith, different expressions of Christianity have used various means to signal that. For some, it's coming forward at the end of a church service. For some, it's a prayer that you pray, or it's raising your hand, or something else. And those are good things. But in the Bible, the one definitive way to say to Jesus, I'm in, is to be baptized. The act of baptism is a way to identify with Jesus' death and his resurrection. So like when people go under the water, it represents death. When they come up out of the water, it represents resurrection and new life. Paul explains it like this in Romans 6, and I like Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of this in the Message. It says, that is what happened in baptism. When we went under the water, we left the old country of sin behind. When we came up out of the water, we entered into the new country of grace, a new life in a new land. That's what baptism into the life of Jesus means. When we are lowered into the water, it's like the burial of Jesus. When we're raised up out of the water, it's like the resurrection of Jesus. Each of us is raised into a light-filled world by our Father so we can see where we're going in our new grace sovereign country. Baptism is a statement to God that I'm in for all of this. And baptism is like the first step. It's not the last. Like you initially say yes to the story of Jesus through baptism, and then what happens is you spend the rest of your life trying to figure out what you just said yes to. It's an adventure. And that adventure will include working through questions and doubts and habits and struggles. Like you can't possibly have everything figured out that you need to figure out before you get baptized. If it required that, here's the thing. No one would ever get baptized. What you have to do is you have to be in a spot where you say, Jesus, I'm putting my trust in you. Imperfectly, but I'm putting my trust in you. So heal me and teach me and make me new. I'm in. And many of you have done that. And now you're working it all out. Like, what have I got myself into? You're working it out, and it's beautiful, and it's scary, and it's hard, and it's amazing. Others of you, you're ready to take that step. Like, it's your time. As Jen mentioned earlier, we're baptizing people next week. So if you think you might be interested in that and you want to have a conversation, my gosh, please reach out to me. And you can do that by texting the number here. You can do it by filling out your communication card and dropping it in the basket that's by the door on the way out, just marking that box. You can do it with your online Connect card. If you have my contact info, my email or text, you can text me. You can text Jen if you know her. There's a lot of ways to do this, you guys. And if you're ready, if it's your time, man, do it. Today we're wrapping up this series that we've been in for the last 3 months. Thank you. It's always hard to tell when if people are cheering because they're cheering like, this has been great, or they're like, thank God this is over. But for... and if it's the last one, keep it to yourself. For 3 months, we've been asking the question, like, how do we hear and learn to hear the compassionate voice of Jesus? Like, in a world that is filled with ever-increasing noise, how do we isolate the voice of the one who loves us and listen to it and follow it? And in closing today, I want to tweak this just a little bit and ask a little different question from a little different angle. I just want to ask, we've been asking how do we hear? What I want to close with today is why. Why listen for the voice of Jesus among all the other voices? And the bottom line is this, because he adores you. Because he adores you, and he wants to lead you to life. Because if you are willing to look into his face, you're going to find nothing but love looking back at you. No matter the choices you've made, no matter the choices you haven't made, he adores you. He is for you. He is in your corner. He is fighting for you. He's gracious and he's compassionate, and he knows what you need better than you do, and he knows what you need better than all the other voices that are making up all the noise in our world. So wherever he's leading you, go. It'll be good for you in the long run. It might be hard. It might be painful in the short term. You might have to walk through really difficult stuff. But even in that, his love will carry you. It will always lead you to life in the end. And if your next step is to be baptized, if that's an obvious next step, then get baptized. For many of you, your next step is something else. Maybe you've been hearing his voice speaking to you. Maybe for weeks or for months or for years, he's been speaking to you about something. And you can do that thing, and you can step into that thing or not. I met up with an old friend of mine on Friday who has been, he's been like reading the Bible and journaling, and we meet together every so often for him to process it. And we met up on Friday, and he had this sense coming out of our time together that Jesus was saying to him, bro, you need to spend more time with your kids. You need to like spend time with them that is not in the rush and the clutter of everyday life and all the, hey, do you have all your stuff? And would you clean up? And did you clean your room? And did you put your dishes away? And did you brush your teeth? And but just time where there's none of that on the table. It's just time to talk about life and to get into their world and to hear their heart with no pressure, no hurry. And so he decided, you know what, I'm going to set up a time every week while my kids are still in my house. I'm going to set up a time every week with each one of them to go for a walk with them. And I'm just going to ask them about their life and talk to them about whatever they want to talk about. For him, that's the step. He can do that or he cannot do that. God could be inviting you into all kinds of things. He could be saying, hey, end this, start this, do this, move into this. But maybe right now, he's been speaking to you. Maybe it's for weeks, months, years. Maybe he's speaking to you right now this morning about a particular thing in your life. He's directing your steps in some way. Like if you want to follow Jesus, here's what you do. When you sense the next step you should take, take it. You don't have to have everything figured out. You just do the thing you already know to do. And when you've done that, you keep listening and you take the next step. It's that simple. I think about my friend, and he's going to go on a walk with one of his kids, right? And this is something that they're going to do weekly. He can do that or not do that. But here's what I expect to happen. He's going to go on those walks, and when he's on those walks, something's going to come up, and God's going to speak to him about something else. And it's going to be really important. And it's something that he wouldn't hear unless he took the initial step. And here's the thing. He wouldn't have heard to go on these walks and do this kind of thing unless he had taken the initial step of deciding, you know what, I'm going to read my Bible and I'm going to journal about it and then I'm going to talk to somebody about it. It's been one step after another that leads to life and more life and more life. If you have a step in front of you, take it. You don't know where it's going to lead. And you don't know where God might speak to you from there about the next thing. And so let me just ask, what is the thing that Jesus is speaking to you about these days? Whatever that is, listen, go, do it, trust him. Why? Because it will lead to other steps. And once you do that, then you listen and he'll keep speaking and he will lead you to wholeness and he will lead you to beauty and he will lead you to good things like you would never imagine because that's what he does because he adores you. The process of new life is not rocket science. It's listening for the voice of Jesus, and it's taking one step at a time. If you trust him and you go where he leads, it will change everything. Jesus is saying the same thing to you and me that he said to a broken woman 2,000 years ago. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? To close, I just want to read some ancient words over you this morning. These are the words of Paul to other followers of Jesus that he hadn't even met yet in Rome. And so I just want to ask you, would you stand and bow your head as I read these, what I think are just beautiful words over you? So what do you think? With God on our side like this, how can we lose? If God didn't hesitate to put everything on the line for us, embracing our condition and exposing himself to the worst by sending his own son, is there anything else he wouldn't gladly and freely do for us? And who would dare tangle with God by messing with one of God's chosen? Who would dare even to point a finger? The one who died for us, who was raised to life for us, is in the presence of God at this very moment sticking up for us. Do you think anyone is going to be able to drive a wedge between us and Christ's love for us? There is no way. Not trouble, not hard times, not hatred, not hunger, not homelessness, not bullying threats, not backstabbing. None of this phases us because Jesus loves us. I'm absolutely convinced that nothing living or dead, angelic or demonic, today or tomorrow, high or low, thinkable or unthinkable, absolutely nothing can get between us and God's love because of the way that Jesus, our Master, has embraced us.